Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. You can find Inforum online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Bob Sipshin, Editor-in-Chief of Sierra Magazine. Tonight we have a special guest, Gil Peñalosa. As Commissioner of Parks, Sport, and Recreation for Bogota, Colombia, Gil created one of the most successful and renowned parks and recreation systems in the world. Every Sunday, over 1.5 million people come out weekly to walk, run, skate, and bike on the Ciclovia, 120 kilometers of car-free roads in Bogota. Gil is also executive director of the Canadian nonprofit Walk and Bike for Life, and is currently a consultant for cities starting similar projects all over the world. Please welcome Gil Peñalosa.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Before coming here this afternoon, well, Leah had me working all over. I was at a meeting with the Open Space Task Force, and it was really, really great because one of the things of the open spaces is the places also where people walk and bike and also meet and develop communities. And I want to share with you some of the images because one of the things we were talking about was how there is a myth that walkable communities is just about building sidewalks. The other day I was talking to a mayor in one of the Canadian cities, and I said, you know, we're going to do a cycling and pedestrian master plan. And then she said, no, we don't need pedestrian because we already have sidewalks. And so I said, you know, actually, there is more to walking than walking. So I want to share some ideas. For example, you know, this is in Copenhagen. And, you know, creating walkable places, it's also about economic vibrancy. You know, when they had this in Copenhagen, can you imagine when the mayor said he was going to eliminate these 90 parking spots? Then everybody started complaining. The retail said, oh, we're going to go broke. No one is going to come to our shops if people cannot park in front of the stores. But look what happened. Yeah. It's a fantastic place, and it's very vibrant and exciting all the time, all year long. So these are the kind of things that we got to do all over the place. This is New Haven, Connecticut. I'm a senior consultant with Project for Public Spaces in New York, and when we saw this, you know, it was a corner where no one wanted to spend 1 second more that they had to, you know. It was very dangerous. You went right through it. There was no reasons to stop. So we went to the community, with a blank page, and we said, okay, what would you like to do? You know, it's turning things upside down. It's not the professional is the expert and the community supports, but no, it's the community is the expert and the professional support. So then the community said, you know, why don't we eliminate the first two spots for parking? And then someone else said, okay, why don't we widen the sidewalk? And then somebody else said, why don't we put a bench? And then why don't we put a tree? And why don't we put a light? And why don't we ask the retail to fix the facade? But, you know, to make things short, you know, it went from being one corner where you didn't want to spend 1 second more than you had to one where you don't want to live, you know. It becomes a meeting place. So, you know, public places is not just about citywide projects, but a corner. And if you don't have just one corner in your neighborhood, but then all of a sudden it's 5 or 10, then you got a fantastic neighborhood. You know, this is Detroit. Detroit, 40 years ago, had 2 million people. Now it has 900,000. This is downtown Detroit. And a similar process to the street corner in New Haven was done at the core of Detroit. And then the community came up with this design, and it was built 3 years ago. And now it's a fantastic place during the winter and during the summer and all the time. So it was exciting to share some of these ideas. Because, you know, it's... You know, there is not. Sometimes people think that there is going to be a Martian coming down to fix the city. No, it's up to us. We are building the cities, you know. So we can do this. Can you imagine what this neighborhood looked like before they built the road? You know, there was a lot of things in common between the neighborhoods. Then they built the road, and they broke that in two. So are we going to do streets for cars or streets for people? You know, because it's totally different. It's up to us. How are we going to build the cities? So, you know, are we going to do we want to live in this kind of neighborhood where the roads are more like car storage space, or places where you actually get to meet the neighbors, you know? So these are some of the, so it was nice to meet with them. And because at the end of the day, I also do work with Gehl Architects, a Danish firm, and I'm a senior consultant with them. And basically, you know, the cities have everything to departmentalize. So one department looks after the buildings, another one after the roads, another one the trees, and they don't talk to each other. And there's a power struggle and jealousy. Come on, this is one city, one taxpayer. So we got to eliminate barriers, eliminate silo mentality, and we got to talk to each other, the school boards, the public health, everybody, and think more holistically how we create the cities. So then we said, I was asking them whether parks and open spaces was important to this task force. They were holding a workshop. And then, you know, I said, let's go over some concepts that are similar but are different, whether the parks are important, what makes a park great, and what makes the power of 10 the uses, and what makes a city system great. And then whether the parks are great or important, then we went through it because there are some emotional and emotional reasons, others are quantifiable. Like the emotionals, for example, you know, they provide happiness. I know that happiness is something that is hard to define and even almost impossible to measure. But nevertheless, that's our goal in life. You know, like so many things in life, that affection and friendship, same, it's hard to define, impossible to measure. Also, the open spaces, they strengthen communities, actually, because that's where you see people, you know. It improves safety. Where is it that you meet the parents of your kids' friends? In the parks and open spaces. So that's where they become important. And also, they are a great equalizer. You know, when people are cycling or walking, everybody's the same. And you see people and you see faces, and that's why it's important. But also, they increase property value, so the city gets more property tax, and it's good for tourism and economic activity, and improves the health, improves the environment. And then we went through a few symptoms. These symptoms are important when you go out tomorrow and you look at public places, sidewalks, plazas, squares, some of the symptoms, because you hear a lot when you really listen, and you also see a lot by really observing. For example, you know, you got to have good places to sit. This guy, he would not be as happy if he was sitting on a bench. He needed 5 chairs, one for his Big Mac, one on his feet, you know. Good places to sit, you know. They say monkey see, monkey does. Sometimes it's the other way around. People see, people do. No? When you don't have good public places, that's what happens. You know, they were putting nails so the kids would not sit. You know, how about this guy? You know, he has to bring his own suitcase as a chair. This one gave up. How about this one? She's sitting on her baby. Look at that. So we need better, you know, this, Barcelona has done a lot of great things, but this is not one of them. You go there, you take a photo, you never go back. Why would you go back? There is nothing to do, you know. So good places to sit. Instead, these are really nice places. So then you are walkable, and you really want to go there, you know, where a woman can, an older woman can go in the middle of the winter to read the papers. You know, movable chairs are fantastic because then people sit wherever they want, usually not facing each other but facing other people. The people want to see people. Or like these women that they were talking, you know, it started to rain and they wouldn't move. And then I said, you know, it's probably because they were talking about their husbands. And then one woman told me, Gil, you are wrong. You don't know women. They were talking about shoes. And benches. We need a lot of nice benches in San Francisco. This one is from Paris. I got hundreds of photos, but this is one of the benches that I like the most. Because, you know, you see 5 different groups of people doing 5 different activities, and no one cares what the other 4 are doing. So it's coming. Other symptoms, sociability. When you go to public places and the people are sociable, it's really, usually good places, you know. Diversity. If you go to a public place and there is only children or only adults or only men or only women, usually are not very good. People in groups. Like, what do the youth do when they go to the park? They watch people. What do the adults do? They watch people. Higher proportion of women. The women are more selective of public places. So if they are safe and clean, usually they go. But if they are not safe, they don't go. So you go to a place and there are not a high proportion of women, usually it's another symptom. You know, affection. Affection is very important. You are affectionate with your kids, with your friends, when you are relaxed, when you are at ease. So that's another symptom of good public places. So I was sharing some of these ideas with these people. Actually, someone told me, hey, Gil, don't show this picture because people won't believe that there is so much affection in the public places. But, you know, that was the Central Park in New York. But so these are some of the symptoms. And then we went through what makes a park or open space great. And we went through is how public places need to be managed. Successful public places, one-third of it is design. Two-thirds of it is management. You know, we invest millions in public places, and then we think that God is going to take care of it. We think that all we have to do is pick up the garbage and cut the grass. You know, when we do buildings, any community center, as long as we're putting bricks and roof and whatever, we put on the budget for a manager and supervisor of fitness, supervisor of aquatics, customer service. We build parks and nothing. We say, oh, we don't have any money for management. You know, we should think of the parks almost as an outdoor community centers. And we need supervisors not of fitness and aquatics, but we need supervisors of community engagement and programming and activities day and night and in the summer and in the winter, all year round. So we went through some of those characteristics, and then we went through what makes a citywide park system good. So this has a lot to do with all of this walkable and bikeable. And actually, that reminded me that a few weeks ago, I was in Chihuahua, Mexico, and at a forum on urban planning. And they had, parallel to the forum, they had some kids, and they were asking them to dream. How do they see Chihuahua 20 years from now? And it was very interesting what they were doing, because, you know, actually, they were even putting solar panels and things. And, you know, this kid is fantastic. He's only 13 years old, and in one chart, he has urban planning 101. He said, we want a few cars. He said, we want many people walking, more people cycling. And then he included pedestrians, cyclists, buses, and cars. You know, he realizes at 13 that the four of them go at different speeds, so each one of them need their own space. When you mix pedestrians and cyclists, the pedestrian gets hurt. When you mix cyclists and cars, the cyclist gets hurt. So, and then on top of that, he had some drawing of public parks, and then he included some low buildings with a lot of street-level activity. And what a fantastic community. He's the future planning director of Chihuahua. So what kind of cities are we going to build? You know, the reality if our model of cities is Houston, we're going to build a very different one than if it's Copenhagen. So what kind of cities are we going to build? How do we want to live? You know, the reality is that if we want our kids to walk to school, we got to make small schools so that the area we influence is small. If we want people to actually go and buy eggs or milk walking or cycling, then we got to have corner stores within walking or cycling distance. We cannot just tell people, oh, don't waste a gallon or a liter of gas buying a liter of milk if the closest one is 5 miles away. So how do we want to live? Because the reality is that when we define our cities around cars, what do we get? We get more cars. And then we got to invite our friends to help us cross the street. The population is getting older, and the streets are getting wider, and this is reality. But when we define our cities around people, then we get more people and happier and healthier people. And actually, we get also a better quality of life for all. And the other day, someone was telling me, Gil, haven't you noticed that there is an economic crisis? You cannot talk about quality of life. You know, the reality is that in an ever more globalized world, the most important tool of economic competitiveness is quality of life. Because in an ever more globalized world, the best carpenter or the best engineer or the best doctor or the best artist, they can live anywhere they want to. So why would they live in San Francisco and not in Copenhagen or Sao Paulo or New York or Mexico or whatever? So we really have to improve the quality of life of our neighborhoods, because if a neighborhood doesn't provide good quality of life, people will go to another neighborhood. And then if our city doesn't provide good quality of life, they will go to another city or another country. It's not an issue of quantity of people, but quality. Eventually, you know, as long as the U.S. opens the doors a little bit, you're going to get millions of people. So it's not quantity, it's quality. So that's why if we want to compete in the world stage, every city, San Francisco is going to compete, has to have fantastic quality of life. So we got to keep thinking that a good community is not really a matter of engineering. It's much more akin to art. So let's keep that in mind as we talk today. And I'm very happy, and I want to thank the San Francisco Bike Coalition, especially Leah. I think that if San Francisco had 10 Leahs, it would be a fantastic city. Her energy, her enthusiasm, her positive attitude is fantastic. It radiates. And, you know, she's the envy of every city across North America. When I go, people, oh, no, Leah in San Francisco. We need a Leah here. So you got to clone yourself and go all over. And also I'm very happy with the Commonwealth Club and as well as the Shape Up San Francisco Coalition, where I was today at noon, because what they're doing is very interesting. But let me briefly go about why we got to go beyond baby steps, and we got to really make major leaps. And I think that we are facing a perfect storm. And, you know, and actually someone was telling me, I was very happy with what took place in the U.S. last Tuesday. It was... But then someone said, oh, you know, but the president-elect is not going to be able to do anything because there is no money. You know, totally wrong, you know. I think that... it's much better that there is a complete crisis, because when people are in crisis, people are more willing to change. When things are, sometimes it's a lot easier to go from bad to great than from good to great. When things are okay, good, people are very risk averse. Instead, when things are bad, people are saying, you know, oh, whatever he says, you know, it's the time to make bold decisions. It's the time to be innovative and creative and think outside the box. And really, you know, it's not an issue of money. We got to stretch the dollar. And actually, that's why also walking and cycling and public places is so important, because that is less expensive than any other options. And we're going to see some examples of that. For example, through the nonprofit that I lead in Canada, Walk and Bike for Life, we got to do a much better job at promoting walkable and bikeable communities. You know, if 20 years ago we would have thought, you know, what are the ideal conditions to promote more human-oriented cities? Well, everything is taking place now. We got global warming, and we got obesity crisis and traffic congestion and gas prices and what. But nevertheless, we are talking about a lot of these things, but we're not doing enough. Not enough things are taking place. You know, baby steps here or there. Sometimes people say, oh, Gil, finally we're getting a bike lane here. I say, no, you know, that would have been nice 20 years ago. Now we really have to do something bold and ambitious. So we got to become better, and we got to have different arguments. We got to show the decision makers that walking and cycling and public places are part of the solution and not part of the problem. So that when they see the advocates, when they see Leah walking in, they say, Leah, please, welcome. They're going to have the red carpet, because they know that she's part of the solution. She's not part of the problem, because she's part of solving global warming, and she's part of the solution of obesity crisis, and also part of the solution of the traffic congestion. So we got to reposition ourselves that we are not just fun and games, but it's fun and games, walking and cycling on public spaces, but it's also much more than that. So I'm just going to go. We have developed the acronym of EARTH, that is Environment, Economic Activity, Recreation, Transportation, and Health. But due to time, I'm only going to talk about the last two, transportation and health, because there are some problematic symptoms. You know, too many people are driving to the gym to walk on a treadmill. And there are other problematic symptoms that they don't need any words. 24-hour fitness. So... but walking is a mode of transportation. Everybody's pedestrians, and we really gotta pay attention to the pedestrians. Sometimes people say, no, in San Francisco, in some of the wealthy neighborhoods, everybody drives. No, even in the wealthiest and most sprawl neighborhoods of San Francisco, at least one out of three people do not drive. You know, everyone under 17, so 30% of the over 60, and 15% of the 18 to 60. So to have good pedestrian and cycling facilities, it's not something nice to do. It's almost a human right. It's the right to mobility. You know, and this is what happens, for example, when you go to any commercial driveway. The cars are coming out and they stop right before the pavement. And then they see only the cars coming one way. They don't see the pedestrians and cyclists coming the other way. And then they hit. You know that in the U.S., more pedestrians and cyclists are killed every year than all the Americans that have died in the war in Iraq since the war started. Every year. And it's because of these things. How do you solve this? Well, simple. The city passes a law by law that says you got to have a stop sign, a sign saying look both ways, painting on the pavement. And if you don't stop before the sidewalk, you should get a ticket as much as if you had gone through a red light. You know, these kind of things. Also, walking and cycling is a fantastic link to the transit systems. What happened? Then it is a fantastic link to any transit system. But then we also got to have good parking, quantity, quality, and location. You know, like this school, there is no vandalism. Why? Because the bicycle parking is in front of the principal's office. So we got to have the bicycle parking, you know, the closest parking to the door of any commercial place should be for handicap, next to them for bicycles. So then this is the kind of things that we need all over the place. And then someday we'll have this kind of bicycle parking in San Francisco. And then from health, you know, is this the shape of things to come? You know, is this what our future looks like? No, the reality is that even the best public health system in the world will not survive if health is not preventive. You know, it cannot be curative, you know. So, and things like obesity, you know, obesity and basically the lack of physical activity is creating so many issues. People are dying of heart attacks, of respiratory problems, of depression, of all kinds of things that are lifestyle related. So we got to change our culture, the way we live. You know, when people say, oh, it's always been like that. No, yes, if you take a look at the obesity rates in the U.S. since 1985, when very few states had even 10% obesity crisis, that's 85, that's 90, 95, 2000, 2004, 2005. Some states have more than 1 out of 3 people obese. It's not overweight, obese, so it's more than 30 pounds on average. So, you know, we're investing billions and billions that could be spent in parks and bikeways and pedestrian facilities. But instead, and what does this have to do with walking and cycling? When you take a look at the countries that have a higher percentage of walking and cycling has a much lower rate of obesity. This is the same. The green line is the percentage of people walking, cycling, or taking transit. The red line is the obesity line. So in the U.S., we are writing a lot. There's a lot of media publications. Obesity rates are going up. The publications are going up. But the physical activity is flat. So maybe we got to learn from the British and be more aggressive in the advertising. So, you know, here it says, get your 30 minutes a day anyway. It's the British Heart Foundation. So, but nevertheless, all of this also presents a perfect opportunity. So the stars are aligned. It's the time to really be bold. You know, the new government, the obesity, the global warming, the economic crisis, all of this, it presents a fantastic opportunity. But then we got to eliminate some myths. One is that walking and cycling is not safe. You know, if in the U.S. there was a plane fell down every day, something would be done about it. Can you imagine a plane yesterday, another today, another tomorrow? Well, that's what happens every day. 13 pedestrians are killed and 274 are injured, and 2 cyclists. You know, in the U.S., over 100,000 pedestrians are injured by cars every year. Every year. So then someone told me the other day, Gil, you see, that's why I don't walk and I don't bike, because it's too dangerous. And then I said, yeah, you know, you remind me of the guy that went home and found his wife kissing the next door neighbor on the couch. So then he sold the couch. But there is no need to sell the couch. Because the problem is not walking or cycling. You know, Europe has a lot more bike travel. Here's the US, Australia, US, Canada. And far fewer deaths. And when you take into account walking, it also has far fewer walking and far fewer deaths. So walking and cycling can be made safe. Cities like Munster, Germany, has over 600,000 bike trips per injury, not per fatality, per injury. And then people say, oh, cycling is divine in Munster, just because the nuns ride their bikes. No, the reality is that Munster has built a really nice facility where they got the bikes in one area, the cars in another, the pedestrians in another. And then it's safe, and then they got the safe crosswalks. Then also people say there is a myth that infrastructure, cycling is just about painting lines on the pavement. That might be nice on small neighborhood roads, but not on arterials. You know, first, the transportation, you can have priorities. Pedestrians first. You know, from the point of view of vulnerability, the pedestrians are the most vulnerable. So pedestrians are first, cyclists second, transit third, and then car and others. And actually, pedestrians and cyclists should be the best of friends, because both of them are not motorized, both don't generate any noise, both see face-to-face, develop community. So we really got to work on improving the relationship between pedestrians and cyclists. And actually, this is something that came out of Portland, which is very interesting, where they saw that when they started painting lines, people started biking more, and they went from 1% to 5%, but then it became flat when they thought it was going to go to 30 or 40% like in Europe. And one of the things that they found is that they did a major study that 1% of the population are the strong and the fearless riders. They are the ones that I call the kamikaze cyclists. And many of us have been kamikaze at some point. But you know, the kamikaze, they don't need facilities. Even if you build them, they might not even use them. But then they found that also a third of the population on the other side, they will not bike, no matter what kind of facility, no way, no how. But they found that there is about 10% here that are enthusiastic and confident that if you build some kind of facility, even bike lanes, some of them might use them, such as students and young people. But the most interesting thing they found is that there's a huge section of the population that want to bike, but they want to have low volume, low speed roads, and they want to have separate facilities from pedestrians, cyclists, and cars. So who do we want cycling? When we develop a bike plan in San Francisco, when we start building, are we going to build for this 1% or for the interested and concerned? So I think we got to have transportation systems for all. Like John Pusher from Rutgers University says, we need to make cycling safe, convenient, attractive, and feasible for everyone. You know, the pedestrians walk at about 3 miles an hour, the cyclists go at around 10, and the cars on arterials go at over 30 miles an hour. So each one needs separate facilities, you know, because think of the 880 rule. Whenever you're talking with an engineer about bike or pedestrian facilities, the 880 rule is, would think of someone that you really love that is around 8 years old, and someone that you really love around 80 years old, and think, would I send the 8-year-old and the 80-year-old on a walking or cycling on those facilities? If you would, it's safe enough. If you would not, it's not safe enough. So we got to build facilities for everyone, and that's the 880 rule. Because when you do lines, you know, the cars, they think they can go anywhere, and they stop, and, you know, Paris have done a lot of nice things, but they still got to improve some of those. And when all you have between you and an SUV is a line, then you go on the sidewalk, and then the pedestrian is... Think of the 880. Would you send the 8 or the 80 on this bike lane in Minneapolis? The cars are going one way, the buses the other, and the cyclists in the middle. That's a bike lane designed for kamikazes. So you need some kind of physical separation, such as this one's in Ottawa. You know, in Montreal, as soon as they started doing this, more women, more older people, more children started riding. So these are the kind of facilities that people are doing all over the place to really increase. This is Paris. You know, moving the car parts, move them on the side, put a physical separation, and get the people, and then it works. Melbourne. You know, this is what they're doing in Copenhagen. And actually, this is I'm with Gale Architects working on the plan for Mexico City. And the mayor has publicly committed to build 250 miles in the next 4 years of physical separated. That is going to have the road at one level, about 5 inches higher for cyclists, and another 5 inches higher for pedestrians. So there is a physical separation that makes it very clear that even in the snow, people can bike and walk, and it's safe for the pedestrians and for the cyclists and for the cars. Last year, the Commissioner of Planning of New York and the Commissioner of Transportation went to Copenhagen. And when they returned for Copenhagen, the Commissioner of Transportation, Janet Sarek, said on the New York Times, Janet Sarek Khan said, it represents the kind of innovative ideas, the pedestrians, the cyclists, a buffer, and the cars. You know, not 3 years later, 30 days later, she had transformed 9th Avenue. 30 days later. Can you imagine? Fantastic. So then had the in 30 days, you cannot build the buffer in concrete. But then she had the bollards and the space and whatever. So it was very interesting. These photos I took on Broadway Avenue 120 days ago. Can you imagine this 120 days? This is the bike lane, you know, for the 880. Not really. Because then what happens? All over New York, you got these white bicycles on the corner, and then they put out, you know, Albert or whatever was killed on April. But look what they're doing in Manhattan. This was taken 30 days ago. They are creating a fantastic, they are taking away two lanes from the cars and creating spaces for pedestrians, for cyclists, even places where people can go. This is from the New York, from the New York Times. Look, now they're putting umbrellas and coffee and cappuccinos. And this is the DOT. It is led by the Department of Transportation. Isn't it fantastic? And then I'm going to mention a couple of things on Bogota, Colombia. Not because I was commissioner there, or because afterwards one of my brothers became mayor. Maybe I did something good. But because Bogota has 1/10 the per capita income of the U.S. And Bogota is not at the same level of San Francisco. I'm not saying that. But it was a city that was almost hopeless, and now it's hopeful. And for example, in these 6 years, from 95 to 2001, we designed and built 5 metropolitan parks, 50 zone parks, and over 800 neighborhood parks. Like this one is 360 hectares, so it's like 889 acres. And when the Pope came 30 years earlier, this is what it looked like. All they did was planted some trees, and they put a fence around. There were no sidewalks, no paths, not a garbage, nothing. And in 30 months, we went from this to this, including lakes, including paths, including sidewalks, crosswalks, playgrounds, places for concerts, wave pools, you know, silo mentality. The commissioner of education needed a library. We needed a park. So we said, come on, do their library. You know, it's one administration, it's one city. And then we did facilities, velodromes and skateboard parks. And then when we opened 10 years ago, we started with a summer festival, doing activities that usually did not take place on the parks. And these are some of the kite festivals. And it's very, very well used, as you can see, on any Sunday. And I like all types of parks, but some of the ones that I like the most are the linear parks. This is one that we did across the city, 18 miles across the city, because the linear parks connect. We started in one of the wealthiest parts of the city, so we did flower shops around there, and then we started going across the city, separating pedestrians and cyclists. Every road was crossed with a bridge so that the cyclists and the pedestrians would never have to stop at any road. And it ended here near the Bogota River, and this was before. And this was after. We're in one of the poorest areas of the city, so we connected them, including commercial areas and residentials, and this is quite nice. And we also did over 174 miles of physically separated bicycle paths, and the bike share went from less than 0.5% to 5%. And then these are some of those. Including the BRT, in the BRT system, then bike parking so that people can access the BRT system on walking and cycling. And actually, this is one of the poorest neighborhoods of the city where there are not even paved parks on this. You cannot even imagine this when you live in San Francisco. But nevertheless, we did some fantastic bike paths. And because part of it is for safety. The other part of it is to send a message that a person on a $30 bike is as important as someone on a $30,000 car. You know? So these were some of the facilities. And then look at how happy that little girl is that her dad is taking her to school. So beyond baby steps, some of the things that we did were like the ciclovia. Ooh, 2 minutes, I'm going to go really, really fast. The ciclovia, what is basically, it's from every Sunday from 7 a.m. till 2 p.m., we open the roads to the people to walk and bike, and we close them to cars. And then the nice thing is that you use the existing infrastructure. Now that there is an economic crisis, this is something that could be done in any city across North America, actually any city in the world. We went, in a couple of years, went from 8 miles to 56 miles to 70 miles. And more important, we're getting, in a city of 7 million people, we're getting 1.5 million people going out every Sunday of the year. And then it covers all the city, which is very important. And these are some of the people that work on it, and signage, and then food vendors and bike repairs and information and aerobics, because not everybody wants to walk or bike. And some people want to do mountain climbing. And you know, American Airlines had the other day 12 full color pages on the ciclovia. So these are some of the things that are interesting. And then there's the Bogota Car Free Day that I can talk afterwards. But we got to think outside the box. And thinking outside the box, because the definition of insanity is doing things the same way over and over and expecting different results. But so even if it seems riskier outside the box, there is a lot more going outside the box, you know, such as the London, the congestion charge, such as Seoul, Korea, when they did a road on top of a river, and then when it was full, they did a second floor, and then when they wanted to do the third, someone had more sense and took it down, and it's fantastic. Like public bikes everywhere. That's Paris. Can I have 2 minutes, please? Then this, for example, the 1,451 bike stations all over Paris. Just to put the stations, they eliminated 7,000 car parking. Can you imagine? Fantastic. But then you need political will. You need political guts in some of those decisions. And then it's Vélib, which is Velocity and Liberty. And they got 20 of these bike shops. This one is on a boat that goes up and down the Seine River. And then inside, they got all of these mechanics working on the bikes and on the bike parts. And some others go around taking care of the computers and the system and the flat tires. And the public bike system is fantastic. They are having over 300,000 uses per day, which is very, very, very impressive. People of all ages are doing, you know, even the youth. That's why you need 20 shops to maintain. Some others use them in a more normal way. Okay, so let me skip Copenhagen because... Okay, then I'll show 4 photos of Copenhagen. Copenhagen. Why Copenhagen is important? Because it's closer to the North Pole than San Francisco. It has higher per capita income. It has higher levels of education. But nevertheless, 4 out of 10 people use their bike as the mode of transportation. In Copenhagen, when they were going to close some streets and make them pedestrians, people said, no. Here we have too many cars, and we love the cars, and the weather is terrible, and it rains. But the more important thing that you will hear in San Francisco all the time is, oh, it's not part of our culture, you know. Pedestrian streets, that's for the Italians, because the Italians are loud and noisy. But we are Danish, and we are cold, and we are serious, and we stay home. Well, guess what? Now the Danish are more Italian than the Italians. And they love their pedestrian streets, and this is the city hall in Copenhagen. And they started with one street in the 62, and then another one 10 years later, and then others, and others. And now they had a whole network of pedestrian streets. And now, you know, you see people of all ages, and you see when they tell you that they have always biked, no, in the 1970s, less than 10% of the people biked in Copenhagen. Today, 4 out of 10 people bike. And did all of this happen because of enlightenment? No, because they had LIAs in Copenhagen that were organizing demonstrations and communications, and they were talking to the politicians and to the engineers and to the planners. This is City Hall in Copenhagen in the 80s. So maybe this was in the 80s. In the 21st century, might be electronic mail and telephone calls. You know, 4 out of 10 people, and even 70% of them do it in the winter, in the snow. You know, and you don't have this in San Francisco. So bicycling has doubled in the last 15 years in Copenhagen. So now they got traffic jams. But wouldn't this be a nice problem to have? You know, and now they want the mayor is very ambitious. Now he came out with a huge plan that by 2015 he wants to go not from 4 out of 10, but 5 out of 10. He wants half of the population to mobilize on bicycle, day and night, weekdays and weekends. So, as we can see in San Francisco, we got challenges, but more than that, we got opportunities. What kind of cities are we building? How do we want to live? You know, it's very clear it's not about the money. And it's not a technical issue either. It takes leadership. It might be the small person in New Haven. It takes political will. It takes political guts. It takes doers in the public sector. In the public sector, we need people that 24/7 are thinking for solutions to the problems and not problems to the solutions. You know, the world needs dreamers and the world needs doers. But above all, the world needs dreamers who do. And 4, we need community engagement. We need people writing to the politicians, to the media. And they got to realize if they're not writing, if they're not communicating, if they're not coming to public meetings, someone else is. And that someone else is setting the agenda. And last, we need a sense of urgency. You know, we need action. We need an attitude of ready, fire, aim. And not ready, aim, aim, aim. So, as I said earlier, the stars are aligned. I wish you good luck and thank you very much.
Thank you, Gil. That was fascinating and inspiring. And whenever I see someone who speaks with that much passion about a subject, I can't help but wonder, how did you become that passionate? You're a product of the 20th century, yet you have these views that are, you know, clearly, from our perspective, futuristic almost. How did you spend a lot of time in parks? Are you a bicyclist?
Well, I think both. I think somehow, on one hand, my mother, she used to be a landscape gardener. And then my father, he was in urban planning. And actually, when the United Nations did the first World Conference on Human Settlements, that was in 76, the habitat, when they created Habitat in Vancouver, he was the Secretary General. He was the number two at the UN, and he led that. So I said, well, maybe my job is to be planting seeds on topics about urban planning. So I think that was part of it. And also I have liked parks all my life. And I think when I got married, one of the things that we did in the second year, we took 9 months and we went camping all over Europe. I had never been to Europe, so we said, are we going to go to one place? Or do we want to go just to many places a couple of days at a time? And we went to over 20 countries. And I never thought I was going to end up working in parks. And I also like to walk and like to bike. And I really like when you said futuristic, because sometimes people think when they're talking about walking or cycling, oh, you guys want to be in the past. No, no, no. This is about the future. It's how to create healthier communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting, because I think it's about the future, but it isn't about the past to an extent. In Los Angeles, I participated a few years ago in something called the Arroyo Fest, where Bob Gottlieb at Occidental College and worked with a bunch of city activists like Leah, and they shut down the oldest freeway in California, the 110 freeway. They shut it down for a morning, and it was only open to bicycles and pedestrians, and it turned LA into a different place. And one of the things I learned in looking at that was that along that same route, back in the early 20th century, there had been an elevated bikeway, a wooden elevated bikeway that ran 8 miles from Pasadena to downtown LA with little gazebos. People were thinking about that, but somehow we lost track of that sort of thinking. I think the automobile disrupted it. Is this the time? Are energy prices and global warming going to remind us that there's an alternative now?
Yeah, I hope that we take advantage of this crisis, because this is a fantastic opportunity. And you're totally right. You know, we got to remind ourselves that we have been building cities for the last 5,000 or 6,000 years. But only during the last 60 or 80 years, we've been building cities thinking more on cars' mobility than on children's happiness. And the two concepts are not compatible. So we got to do things on a different way. And, for example, in Europe, almost all of Europe in the 1970s was going also very much towards the car, becoming very car-friendly. And everybody was promoting things, and they were eliminating the bikes. And then they had the energy crisis. And when they had the energy crisis in Europe in the 70s, many of these countries, including Denmark, they said, okay, we're never going to depend on oil again. So they started promoting solar energy and wind power and walking and cycling. And they went from less than 10% of the people cycling to 40% today. And this took place in many other cities. So I think that hopefully we'll take advantage that all of this crisis, we are going to have to live in a different way. And we're starting to see changes. You know, people now are going to the grocery stores and now they're taking their bags. And there is a lot of different changes. And I think there is a move. And actually, it's not just a coincidence that the president-elect Obama, his main theme was change. So I think that is the time to be bold and ambitious with this change.
I don't know if this is fair, because I don't know how much time you've spent in San Francisco, but given the audience, I thought maybe you'd care to critique the city, maybe the three most livable aspects of the city and the three biggest problems you see.
Oh, that would be irrespectful, disrespectful with San Francisco. I think that I think that everybody knows. I think that just taking a look at some of the photos of some of the symptoms, I do think that every, you know, this is a process of continuous improvement. You are never finished. That's something also. So you always have to get better. You know, Paris, when they came out with these public bikes, it was something that was fantastic. I showed one of the photos, but I was running out of time. For example, in one of the boulevards in Paris, they had 8 lanes of cars. And those 8 lanes of cars, then people were asking the mayor that they couldn't fit, so they needed 12 lanes. So what the mayor did, instead of having 12 lanes, he went down to 4. And he put an LRT in the middle, and he widened the sidewalks. He created separate facilities for bicycles, and it was fantastic. So I think that every city can improve and should improve. I think that maybe one of the worst things is that sometimes when the cities are good, they become complacent, and they become very risk-averse, and they don't want to change. But I think that it's interesting, for example, to see the very innovative things that New York is doing. You know, for many, many years, all the transportation commissioners in New York said, oh, it cannot be done. You know, we got to do environmental studies. The politicians will not let us do it. The taxi drivers, the retail. And all of a sudden, you get this woman that comes, you know, like magic, and makes huge changes. So I think that the same thing is happening in many different places at different levels. So that's why at the end I was saying that you need that. You need the leadership and you need the political will, but you also need the doers in the public sector. And I've been in the public sector. In the public sector, you know, the people that say that it cannot be done, they should step aside and let the ones doing actually do it.
Well, I was talking to Leah, who is a doer, before the meeting, and she would like nothing more than for me to pick your brain here about ways that, you know, San Francisco can improve. But, I mean, I'm thinking sometimes it's better to focus on one thing. And I've been in San Francisco 18 months, and I can't believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Bay Bridge is not going to have any bikeway. It's not going to have any way. Is that half of it will, but it goes nowhere. How could Leah have, you know, when in the planning stages of that bridge, how could she have, and the other activists here, judging from the number of bike bags with little flashing lights on them, I gather there are quite a few bicyclists here. How could they have done something? I mean, are there steps that can be taken that could have mitigated that?
Well, I think that it's very hard to say what Leah should have done because I'm a great admirer of Leah, so how am I going to tell her how to do it? But in general, I think that the cyclists and the pedestrians have to build broader coalitions. Sometimes the cyclists are only thinking about the cyclists. And actually, sometimes the cyclists are very selfish and think actually only about themselves, as if they had they were motherless and fatherless and they don't have any kids because they want facilities only for... No, you know, we got to think about others and we got to bring on board, for example, I think one of the most positive things that is taking place across North America is the involvement of public health. Because when you go and talk to the transportation engineers, that there's a new wave of transportation engineers, but the old wave that were against pedestrians and cyclists, they thought that their job was to move cars, not to move people. Then they would say, oh, you know, no, that's fun and games, you know. But when you bring the public health officer on board, and the public health officer is talking about life and death, then they think of this seriously. So I think that is very important in anything is to bring a broad coalition, bring the business sector, show the business sector, for example, tourism is pedestrian. You know, every city, the best tourist cities in the world, you could have the same museums that you have in New York, in Houston. Nevertheless, Houston would not become a great city because of the museums. People don't go to New York is because it's a fantastic place to walk and it's becoming a fantastic place to bike. And it's a pedestrian, it's a more human city. So we have to start thinking. So bring on board the people from the economic development. Bring on board the people from public health. Bring on board the people from education. You know, sometimes people say, oh, you know, those people on the board of education, they are so stubborn. No, bring them on board. So I think that more than anything, you gotta create a broad coalition so that people realize. Also, it's hard for the cyclists because the reality is that there might be 1% of cyclists in San Francisco. But if San Francisco had a really nice infrastructure, you might have 10 or 15%. So people say, oh, but I don't see the cyclists. Why should we build that bridge for cyclists when it's only 1%? Oh, because if you had a nice infrastructure, you would have 10 or 15%. So we are working with a latent demand. So this is also, and that's why I also think that it's very important for the cyclists to develop partnerships with the pedestrians. And actually, that's one of the things that I was recommending the mayor of Mexico City 2 weeks ago, that I said, look, when you are making a lot of very difficult decisions politically because you are narrowing the car lanes, you are eliminating car parking, and then people are going to say, why are you doing that? For the cyclists, I don't see any cyclists. I see only 1%. And then we say, yeah, but in 2018, we're going to have 10%. But if he says, no, this is not about the cyclists. This is both, it's about the cyclists and the pedestrians. And also take the advantage and improve the sidewalks. Then you build a much broader coalition because pedestrians are 100%. Everybody's pedestrian. So those are the kind of things that I think that would work. And also we got to work with the democracy. I think one of the fantastic things of democracy is that if you don't like the people that are leading, change them. So if the councillors or the mayor or whoever is not doing what we think should be done, then we should get involved also politically.
And that, of course, goes hand in hand with changing the minds of the people who are going to be voting. You have to change policy, but you have to change people's minds too. You showed some slides of advertisements that were interesting and compelling being done in other countries. Is there anything beyond advertising that you recommend for changing public views on these issues?
Yeah, this is a cultural change more than anything else. So we got to think of this as social marketing. The same way that we develop social marketing campaigns so that people plant trees or that people stop smoking, we got to do the social marketing on how to communicate that this is good for society in general. So we got to raise the level of awareness and do something. Also, there are some things that are symbols that work. For example, the mayor of Mexico City, he decided to bike to work once a month. And then he said, the top 100 city staff have to bike once a month. And then a lot of the secretaries and the commissioners said, wow, but this is very dangerous. He said, of course it's very dangerous. I want you to see how dangerous it is. And every month I want you to remember how dangerous it is. Because when we are building we're going to need everybody on board. We need the Secretary of Finance to give out the money fast. We need the Secretary of the Environment to do the environmental reviews fast. We need everybody to work as a team. So then if they bike once a month, they are constantly reminded. So, yeah, this is about a cultural change. It's about living in a different way. So a lot of these things improve. You know, the Sunday streets that San Francisco did that was very successful. It is good because it also raises the level of awareness. It's not because the government or the coalition is on the entertainment business or the event business. No, when they do an event, it's to communicate something. It goes beyond that. Those events are a means to an end. The end is creating the city more human.
Okay. The head of the transportation department in Los Angeles, by the way, drives a Hummer, if that tells you anything. Or at least an SUV, I can't remember. So it's obviously, most of your consulting work is working with cities to make existing cities more livable. Do you ever wish for a blank slate, or are you working with any new cities that are being developed in Dubai, maybe, or...
Well, you know, there are many, many cities in the U.S. that are being developed new. Not cities, but parts of cities. When the U.S. is going to grow by 100 million in the next 35 years, a lot of these are going to be brand new neighborhoods. So it's a fantastic opportunity. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, some cities are not taking advantage. For example, a few months ago, I was in a city in Ontario, Canada, where they're going to develop a new area for 50,000 people. From scratch, there is nothing, only beautiful creeks and woodlots and whatever, and they're going to build it. And said, you know, why don't you do the best, the model, the one that would be the ideal so that this becomes a sample case for other cities. And one of the first things that the city is doing is a park. And in the park, they're doing 16 soccer fields in one park and 6 baseball fields. And I said, this is crazy, you know? This is 1980s planning, when the planning was being done by the guy that cuts the grass. Because then if you have 16 fields in a row, you go, and then you come back. But are we building sports factories, or are we building communities? Does it make more sense to do 16 fields in one place, or one field in 16 places, where actually people can walk to, throw a frisbee, fly a kite, kick the ball around. So these are the kind of things, and that's why we need community engagement. The mm-hmm. community has to get involved, because in many cases, politicians are, unfortunately, are listening too much to the squeaky wheel. That's why we need the leaders of the world. Because when they listen only to the squeaky wheels, then the people that want a different kind of community, the people that wanted more cycling and pedestrian and more human, have to become a squeaky wheel themselves and be louder than the others. Why is that? Why is this community doing the 16 fields in one place? Because the people that are on the soccer club are organized, and they email the counselors, they make the phone calls, they write on the paper, and they get their 16 soccer fields in one place. But the people that want a better community, they're not really organized, and they just talk to their friends saying, how dumb our politicians are. But just by criticizing the politicians, nothing happens. So people have to get involved and have to participate. And I hope that also all of this that is taking place in North America with all of these new voters and whatever, it also will continue. It will not be just a one-week, one-shot, but that people will become more participatory. Because if people do not participate, then we're going to see more and more communities with 16 soccer fields in one place.
I got to be clear on this, though. You're from Colombia, right? So you're not anti-soccer.
No. I want the 16 fields in that community. I just don't think that they should be in one place. Yeah. It could be one in 16 places or two in 8 places, but it doesn't make any sense to have 16 fields in one place. No, I think it's fantastic. Actually, that city has the biggest soccer club in all of Canada. But nevertheless, we got to have very clear.
You have to address the competing interests. Right?
Huh?
You have to address all those competing interests.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was very encouraging to see, for instance, toward the end where you showed the slide of Paris and they had eliminated car lanes and put in bike lanes and there were all the bikes. On the discouraging side, if you look at Beijing or parts of Southeast Asia, at least from what I've seen, the opposite's happening, where there used to be, bicycle used to be the primary form of transportation for most people. Now, as the economy becomes better, they are pushing out the bikes for cars. Do you see any hope for reversing those sorts of trends that seem to be pretty common in part of the developing world?
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I think that's terrible. And in places like China, it's easier, because the government tells people, and then people have to do. For example, in some of the cities, the government already have seen that this is a terrible mistake and that they're moving in the wrong direction. And they are passing mandatory laws that, for example, the people that work for the government cannot drive to work. They got to use their bikes. But then it's a bylaw. They're making it mandatory. But in other places, it's more difficult. For example, I've been doing some work in Cuba. And in Cuba, they had in the late 1990s a crisis, their economic crisis when the USSR had their own crisis. And, they imported 1 million bikes in a country of only 10 million people, so almost one bike for every 10 people from China. And then, like, when you go to the Havana now, you see very few bikes. And you say, what happened to the bikes? And then people say, oh, no, that's the symbol of the crisis. And people, so it has the bicycle all of the sudden took a negative connotation. So I said, wow, this is such a waste. Less than 10% of the household in Cuba have cars. I said, this is the time to create some bold initiatives to do some fantastic bikeways, because sooner or later, this is going to be invaded by cars. So before you are invaded by cars, create a wonderful cycling infrastructure. But, you should turn a crisis, a negative crisis, into a positive, similar to what Copenhagen did. In Denmark and many other European cities, they had their energy crisis in the 70s, but then they turned it into something positive. And you are right. For example, in Colombia, one of the things that we are doing is doing some videos of some cities. For example, we had to do, in order to go to the low-income neighborhoods, where people were saying, oh, you want us to walk our bike? It's because you want us to stay poor all of our lives. So then we had to go to Copenhagen and Amsterdam and other cities and do videos and then go and show them how these cities that have as high or higher per capita income than the states, as high or higher educational levels, also are democratic, but nevertheless, 4 out of 10 people are using their bikes as their mode of transportation in order to say, look, This is a sign of progress. This is a sign of the future, not a sign of the past. And in some ways, we gotta communicate to some of these developing countries that they can bridge the stage of the car. They don't have to go to all the pain of the car in order to end up. It's similar. I use an analogy with the telephones in India. In India, India was very poor and had only 50 million telephones. And then now, over the last 10 or 15 years, their economy has been booming and they're doing very well. And now they got 350 million telephones. And I said, but the 300 million telephones additional, they didn't have to break down all of the sidewalks and put cable under the sidewalk and tear down all of the space. No, they have wireless telephones. So they leapfrog. So I said, I tell the people, you got to do the same with the bicycles. You don't have to imitate the way that the U.S. has grown and Canada and other countries around the car, but leapfrog, don't go through those growing pains and skip that and start doing more walking and more cycling. But that is a major challenge.
Yeah, I sometimes think if the pencil had been invented after the computer, we would look at it as a model of technological elegance. And I think the same is true of the bicycle. It's a model of efficiency, and it's only because the car came after it that perhaps we don't appreciate it the way we should as a mode of transportation. Are you seeing hope in the regional and urban planning schools in the country for sustainability? It seems like that is beginning to really get some traction as a focus of these programs. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that it's beginning, but I think that we have to do something to really make major steps forward. I think people are starting, you know, people are so frustrated that nothing has happened for so many years that when little things happen, they say, oh, finally things are happening. No, but, you know, it's such a major crisis that we cannot be complacent with baby steps. And that's when I think that we got to take major leaps. The other thing is that, for example, in cycling, when we're developing cycling networks, we have to develop at least a minimum grid, because you are, once again, going to the 880 rule. You're not going to send the 80-year-old or the 80. If most of the ride is safe, but 30% of it is in the middle of the cars and the buses. So, you know, if you're building 20 soccer fields, you can do 2 this year, 3 the next, none the other, and people are going to use them. But when you are building a bicycle network, you have to build a complete network. You got to build a complete grid, or else people will not use it. So I think that it's one of the things why we have to be more ambitious on some of these topics. And so although there are a lot of positive signs, many places, you know, the Shape Up San Francisco, and there are a lot of good things. You know, people have been talking about doing car-free Sundays in the U.S. for many years. And all of a sudden, in 2008, it was the first time ever for San Francisco, for Portland, for Chicago, for New York. So, yeah, there is change in the air. But we got to take advantage because, you know, maybe if we don't take advantage of this a few years from now, there might not be that change in the air and things are going to get worse.
Is it generational, do you think? Is sustainability an issue that has greater appeal to people who are young? And is that something that is going to change? Or do people become more averse to physical activity and more convenience-oriented as they get older, or can we hope for, you know, the generation that's now becoming very interested in green issues and sustainability and bicycling and hiking to continue with their interests?
No, I think it's everybody. I think it's going to be very, very good. That, for example, I think the baby boom generation is starting to retire, and I think as I go to public meetings all across North America, I see more and more baby boomers going to those public meetings. And this generation that is going to retire is going to have a lot of time to do volunteer work. And the people retiring now are wealthier and healthier and more active than in the past, are better educated. And I think that's going to transform a lot how public engagement takes place. But I also see at the young people in the school levels, there is also a lot of excitement about environmental issues. And I think there's also more consciousness. So I think that it's not only the young. I also see that at other ages. And I think there's going to be a major shift. For example, I was in Europe 3 months ago when President-elect Obama was there. Who would have thought, can you imagine, that a U.S. politician was going to go to Berlin and have 250,000 people going. You know, if Madonna gets 250,000, it's fantastic. But 200 to go and listen to a speech from a politician. So I think that is not only in the U.S. I think that in many places around the world, people are anxious for hope, for a different way of living. So I think that I don't think it's so much generational. I think that it's one of the things that we are seeing in the polls is that it's across ages and genders and ethnicities and hopefully.
Okay. We're going to be taking questions in just a couple minutes here. So if you have questions and would line up behind the two microphones, that would make it very helpful. That would be very helpful. You're talking about livability, sustainability. Is there an issue of time involved in this? Are we going to have to change in a fundamental way? And is that a reasonable selling point to the public in this age where everything is happening faster and faster? We have the slow food movement. Bicycling to work, whatever else you think about it, takes a little longer usually than, just shooting across the bridge in your car. The parks are places where you slow down your life. Is there a philosophical change that's going to have to occur at a cultural level as well as the sort of policy changes you're talking about?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things that are taking place now that are making people change. For example, the people never thought that the oil was going to go above $100, and then it went above. They think that when you go across the world, there are major climate changes everywhere. People are saying, this is the rainiest month of the year ever, or this is the coldest, or this is the warmest, or this is... So the climate is really going crazy all over the world, and it's very palpable. Like people really feel it. It has rained every day, and they look at the record. It had never happened, or it's been too dry. So every place is different. So I think a lot of these things are creating also the awareness that there is a sense of urgency, that we cannot be complacent and wait forever. So I think that it's a... That people are starting to realize that change needs to happen and that it needs to happen soon. But nevertheless, very recently, even before the Al Gore movie, people were saying, there is no such thing as global warming. That's something that has been created by some left-wing scientist. And that was only 10 years ago, and people were denying global warming. Obesity crisis, the same thing. It's always been like this. So there's a lot of things that need to change. But at the same time, I think that there are a lot of things that are changing. But we need a lot more advocacy, and we need a lot more participation. I think that community engagement is absolutely critical for these changes to take place. They will not take place by themselves.
Okay, we only have a minute left, so I'll ask a very quick question as a surrogate for the audience. Do you have a bike yourself? And if so, what kind?
I have a few. And maybe Leah is going to let me folding bike tomorrow to see if I get a Bike Friday made in Portland, USA. But I got a GT made in Los Angeles, mountain bike, and I have a street bike, and I have a road bike.
Very good.
Although this is not only about the people that have bikes, everywhere where I go, always there is a cycling advocate that says, "Do you bike?" I say, that's irrelevant. It's not if I bike or not. It's if people should bike or not. But yeah, that's always a must question.
As a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're talking with Gil Peñalosa. I'm Bob Sipshin of Sierra Magazine, and now we'll have 20 minutes of questions. Shall we start on the left over here? And please do approach the mic.
Hi, my name is Jake Levitis. I'm in the Sustainability and Planning Group at AirUp. You talked about kind of negotiating different mindsets within a community and implementing community engagement and getting it to be successful. And you talked about the soccer field example as one where people want one outcome that's different from your own and the one that has been proven to be more successful. Another example was Seoul, where they wanted 12 lanes and got it reduced to 4. So I was wondering, after things like that are implemented and proven as successes, 2 fields in 8 places, 4 lanes instead of 12, is there still kind of an us versus them mentality afterwards, or do those people come to the side of you and of other planners of the other consortium, members of a consortium that you bring together of finance, education, public health, like you were talking about. Do you really see after a success takes place that there's kind of more of a consensus and that things can move forward?
Yes, I think that in some cases, yes, some others, no. But in many cases, for example, on pedestrian streets, there have been over 1,000 different municipalities in Europe that in the last 20 years have created pedestrian streets somewhere, taking their cars out permanently and putting pedestrian streets. And at the beginning, always, the retail is very much against. And afterward, the retailers are the best supporters. For example, in Bogota, everybody used to park on the sidewalks. And when the mayor tried to eliminate that, the retail got organized and they paid armies of people to go out and get signatures to impeach the mayor. And actually, they got 300,000 signatures. Luckily, they needed 600,000. But now, afterwards, all of a sudden, they became supporters. They say, oh, no, you know, I always was in favor, but it was my next-door neighbor who was against it. Now you don't find anyone who were the enemies. So I think that it does happen that at the end, once people see the benefits, change is hard. And people sometimes are reluctant to change. And you understand, because sometimes, like when you are going to do the car-free Sundays, you know, the retail have not been seeing that closure. So but then you got to communicate as much as possible. But at the end of the day also, it cannot be done. Change does not happen by consensus, you know. You will never get the coffee shop to say, oh, yeah, please take my car parking and put bicycle racks there. They're going to say, why don't you do it across the street? You know, it's a great idea, but do it in the next door. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are many people at the end of the day, they realize that it was a win-win.
Hi, Gil. You had mentioned early on in your lecture that the success of these public spaces and public systems rely on one-third design and about two-thirds maintenance and management. Could you go into a little more detail on what sort of systems come together to manage these and make them work on an ongoing basis?
Well, one of the things is that I've seen all across North America that I don't know why the public places, we invest millions and millions building the public spaces. But then when we say, well, they need to be managed, all of a sudden there is no budget. And then, but nevertheless, when you see anything that is indoor, as long as it has bricks and a roof, you always have budget. It has a manager and a supervisor of fitness, a supervisor of aquatics, customer service, safety, whatever. And then you wonder why people don't use the public places. Sometimes it's because the design is poor. Sometimes architects design public spaces for the birds because from the air they look really nice, but on the ground they don't. But other times the architects do a really nice job, but there is no management. And what do I mean by management? Is that they got to develop activities. You go to Central Park in New York at any time, and there is 50 different activities. Some people are renting boats, other people are renting bikes, other ones are organizing aerobics, others are doing yoga, others are doing Tai Chi. There are restaurants, fancy restaurants, smaller restaurants, transit, information, movies, concerts. So all of that is what I've said. You need to have uses and activities or else people will not go. Some of the images that I show of Bryant Park in New York that, you know, you go in the daytime and then they have concerts and usually it's for people that work around the area. You go at night and they have a movie night and it's for the people that live in the area because it's different crowds and different people using it. So management also doesn't not mean that it has to be privatized at all. But how are you going to use it? If you're going to have busker people, okay, they also have to have certain rules. How many buskers, how many hours, how many places, what kind of food concessions. So those are the kind of things that I think that make the place vibrant and exciting and get people going so that people not only go, but they return. If you got 10 things to do at the park and you go and do only two or three, you want to go back because there are another seven.
To the left here.
Hi, my name is Carl Betteg, and I'm a member of the SFBC. This is a comment, but perhaps it'll spark something. I agree with Gil when he talked about bicyclists building a big tent, and sometimes we get a little sort of focused on our own concerns, but this is a bicycle comment, and it's really about something that Bob said. talking about how you have to give up a little bit of time to take your bicycle into work, for instance. And I understand that the way the Bay Area is laid out, that may be true for some people, but I just want to at least comment that for a huge number of people living in the city, certainly myself included, the bicycle is by far the fastest way to get around. And when people come to bicycling and they start bicycling, they find this and they say, I can't go back to public transit or I can't go back to driving because I don't have the time to do that anymore. So that's really more a comment. And if Gil has something to contribute to that, I'd be curious. But that's certainly been my experience.
Yeah, no, I think that each cyclist has different needs. For example, I was mentioning that we're doing the cycling master plan for Mexico City. One of the things that we found, Mexico City has 21 million people, the metropolitan area, but the municipality itself has 8 million. Those 8 million people do 20 million trips per day. So one of the things that we found is that the 20 million trips, 11 million are less than 8 kilometers, so less than 5 miles, let's say, less than 5 miles. The other half are more than 5 miles. So it's totally different, the focus, how we approach. Those that are less than 5 miles, the whole trip can be done on a bike. So maybe what they need is they need bicycle parking at the we are studying whether people are going to the school or the grocery store or to work or whatever. So they need some facilities. The people that are going longer than 5 miles, maybe they need link with the public transit. So at the subway stations, at the bus rapid transit, we got to build bicycle parking so that people can actually bike to the mass transit but leave their bike there because no one is going to take their bicycle at rush hour. And then they got to have a reliable parking so that when they return in the evening, they find their bike. So it's different needs. But I also agree that once people start using it, they realize that it's faster and more convenient than it's But we got to make it that way.
I realized as soon as I said it that it wasn't true in large part of San Francisco. On this side.
Hi, I'm Mark Christensen. I'm working with several people in the room to transform a traffic sewer that's in the middle of San Francisco called Masonic Avenue to be a street that everybody can use. And I'm really interested in your comments about separating cyclists in particular from cars. That's something we'll have to think about. I also work with a director-producer who produces the Design E-Squared series. And when I was coming over here, he mentioned that on the piece they'd done, including you, that Bogota had a 30% decrease in crime coinciding with the replanning of the city. I'm just wondering, is that quantifiable as being the result of your planning efforts? Like, are you able to show that specifically in the areas of town or in the center of town compared to the outskirts? Or is there some way in which you're able to say definitively, like, that was the result of getting more bicycles and pedestrians out on the street? Because, I mean, it seems logical to me, but...
There are a lot of studies, and actually a couple of people that are doing their PhD at the University of Chicago and someone else that is doing it in Atlanta, they have been doing a lot of research and they have a lot of numbers. And eventually, homicides went down not by 30%, but like by 70% when the public places and a lot of these things, the parks and the bikeways and the plazas and the squares and a lot of these things started taking place. So, yeah, there are a lot of numbers, as well as, like, on Sundays when we have over 90 miles of bikeways, then also they measure the noise level in the city and also the quality of the air, and all of this has been shown. So there are a lot of quantifiable benefits, and also how the people that, even though it's only on Sunday, but since they want to go on Sunday and they want to feel good walking or cycling or skating on Sunday, then they end up doing physical activity another 2 days a week. So it's kind of like an incentive.
Okay, on the left again, and I'm reminded that we have to limit this to questions, not statements.
Yeah, okay. My name's Zach, and I work at a pretty new bike company, actually. I was wondering if you had ideas for what the private sector should be doing in all this, bike companies and whatnot. Obvious, you know, answers are sponsorship and events and those type of things. But I'm wondering if you see an opportunity to partnership on marketing and pushing biking as a fun, cool, healthy thing beyond, you know, just throwing events and things.
Oh, many, many. I think that it has to be a broad correlation, and I think the private sector can do many, many things. And actually, I think that in general, I think that the public sector should be doing more of the steering and the private sector should be doing more of the rowing. I think that the public sector is very, very bad to do the rowing. For example, the public bicycle system in Paris, the whole system is public, but the one running it is private. In Mexico City, at the National University, they have a public bike system of 2,200 bikes, and it's very impressive to have 2,200 bikes, but it's run by the National University. And then when I was taking a look at it the other day, it was fantastic, the warehouses, everything, until I saw a lot of bikes in one of the warehouses, and I said, what are those bikes doing there? And they said, oh, they are broken. And they got one out of every three bikes are broken. When in Paris, only one out of 10 is in maintenance, and it's because the normal maintenance. So I think that they would have done much better contracting out. So I think that the private sector can do a lot of things. And also, this is good for the economic development. If the cities are vibrant and exciting, at the end of the day, our goal is how to create cities that are more vibrant and communities that are healthier and great places and where the residents are going to be happier. And there's going to be a win-win situation. So they got to improve. For example, Boeing Corporation. Boeing Corporation, when they were looking at headquarters, they narrowed their choice. They did a short list of four cities. And then they put it up to vote to the employees that would be moving which of the cities they chose. And they chose Chicago. And when they asked them why, it was because of the availability of activities to do in the open spaces. They got the parks and the trails and the bikes and the waterfronts and museums and theaters and a lot of the things that can be done in the city. So I think the private sector can be a wonderful partner, and they should be welcome. But the public sector has to take a role, a leading role. For example, I think that the majority of the resources for a program like Sunday Streets has to be from the public sector, because it benefits everybody. The private sector and the not-for-profits and the advocates should be helping out in what the government cannot do. The government is not as good as getting the people involved. So we got to be very careful, because also there is a trend in the U.S. that some of the parks, people say, oh, Central Park, New York is so fantastic, and it's managed by the private sector. So when you go and you say, my neighborhood park is really run down, I need money, they tell you, oh, why don't you do some fundraising? But nevertheless, when I go to the government, I say, there is a pothole on the street, they never tell me to go do some fundraising. They go and take care of it. So why is it that I got to do fundraising for the park, but I don't got to do fundraising for the pothole? And sometimes people don't realize that places like Central Park are unique, because there are very few parks that have the wealthiest people in the world living around it. And they do a really good job, but it's not a model that can be replicated. So in other words, I do think that private sector is very good. We have to engage them. But also, we cannot just leave that responsibility in the private sector. I don't think that the public sector can just say, oh, it's not my problem, it's someone else's. Especially with areas such as walking or cycling that, when you get in Paris over 300,000 people using their public bikes, that's a transportation system in itself. So I do see a role, but I also think that the public sector should lead.
I hope Schwarzenegger doesn't hear that pothole suggestion given the economy. Let's go to this side because I think you were there first.
Since all the world's cities are based on a continuous network of vehicular paths, would it not make sense to start building cities with a raised pedestrian bicycle plane that passes over them and would also be a continuous network and would have its playgrounds and access to buildings, etc., on their own plane so that there was never interference between the two forms of movement?
An elevated...
Yes. An elevated plane. That is being done in some Canadian cities for climate reasons. There's the pedestrian route, for instance, in
Yeah, that's the worst thing that has ever happened in Canada. You know, the elevated connections of the buildings in Canada, for example, cities like Calgary have it, cities like Minneapolis in the U.S. have it, and the people in Minneapolis are very proud of the Skyway because they connect. You know, the reality is that those pedestrians, in Calgary, they call it plus 15s because they are 15 feet above the street level, and in Minneapolis, those kind of pathways that exist. And some places is underground, like in Toronto or Montreal is underground. You know, they actually work, and I have a lot of photos, but we're running out of time. Because one of the things is they work like a gigantic vacuum that suck the life out of the cities.
Why not have the life raised above the streets, leave the streets below as a sewer?
Yeah,
I wrote a book called The End of the Street. Yeah, yeah. That's why I feel rather strongly about this.
Yeah, but when you see those cities, like there isn't not enough people to have life upstairs and downstairs. And the reality is that all the life that takes place in the skyways in Minneapolis or the plus 15s in Calgary is from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. And it's people just walking in totally oriented towards a commercial benefit. And then you don't see youth, and you don't see homeless, and you don't see poor, and you don't see... So it really... And at the same time, the street level of the buildings, you know, walkable cities is not only about short distances, but in addition to being short distance, it has to be enjoyable. And all of a sudden, you go to those cities, you go to Calgary, and the street level of those buildings is terrible. There is nothing. They are totally lifeless. And like in Toronto, that is underground. As soon as you leave the area of downtown Toronto that has this path underground, wow, life blooms. All of a sudden, you start to have coffee shops and flower shops and markets and groceries and people walking and whatever. So it's the reality is that it has proven to be extremely negative. The samples that they have done in Calgary or Minneapolis or...
What about Venice?
We have to just limit it to one question now, although I'm really interested in this too, so maybe we can talk afterwards. Yes, on the right again.
Just that's part of the beauty of your talk. I saw your more detailed talk today at Shape Up SF, and I would just quickly encourage anybody who wants to form a coalition, contact Shape Up SF, because they're the ones who shut down Embarcadero for the Sunday streets. But that's precisely the beauty of everything you're talking about, is that it addresses obesity. You made great points for economic value. I mean, the mass transit. So it's not just a way to get from point A to B, but it's beautiful. So some of the plans and pictures you showed, I'm just sorry that like we were constrained on time here. But I just wanted to say, how would you recommend? You mentioned that linear park, that 18 miles connecting like the poor end of the city to the richer end. I think we're talking about building a subway underground here, like just to do a big loop extending BART. And like we could have like a green beltway, something like that. I think that would be so much like cheaper, but just it would address like a green beltway that would just loop up through North Beach and down through Pack Heights. If I wanted to like get involved, I saw your more detailed speech, your talk at Shape Up. If I wanted to put together that, something to put forth that to Newsom and you know, Crawford and some of the others, I guess I'll approach Leah, but how would you recommend really getting something like that, like put forth? Like, yet such a massive undertaking.
Yeah, no, I think that there is still a lot to be done. That's why we need more advocates and we need public participation, because people are still going after certain things. For example, subways. A subway might be $100 million per kilometer, so like half a mile. And then you go on the BRT, the same thing on a light rail might be 30, on a BRT might be 10. Walking or cycling is nothing, it's peanuts. So it's not an issue of money, it's an issue of priorities. And also how to do this, for example, in Los Angeles, and I also lived in L.A. when I had my MBA from UCLA, and I know that that's not politically correct to say in San Francisco. But they missed a lot of opportunities. For example, with the LA River, that it could have been a fantastic linear park along the LA River, and they just put a big fence around it. And they are trying to revive the plan. But also, when the cities are building like rainwater drainage systems, at the same time that they are doing it, if they build a linear park next to it, it's very inexpensive. So they gotta take advantage of some of those situations, some of those trigger. Because that is what is creating the change. And I think that it's also very good that some of the cities in the U.S. are getting into some of these things because they are competing against each other. And the wonderful thing is that it's a win-win. Because when you are in the private sector and you are selling soft drink A, and in order to get 1% more of the market share, soft drink B has to sell 1% less. But on this, it doesn't happen. In San Mateo has a fantastic park system, and San Francisco also has. It's a win-win. It's good for both. You don't have to choose. In order for one city to be good, it doesn't mean that the other has to be bad. So I think also sharing experiences and maybe saying, okay, how come the commissioner of New York was able to do that 9th Avenue in 30 days? You know, they also have environmental studies. They also have politicians. They also have accountability and media and whatever. So let's find out what did she do that we are not doing in order to take some step forward.
Let's stay on this side. I think you've been there longer.
Thank you. A quick question, hopefully a concise one. I think everybody in the room would agree that to affect change, generally speaking, it's the public leadership. Must begin with the public leadership. What is the language that resonates with them? Is it, you talked about cannibalization, the issue of in a marketing company, A versus B. So is it data? You talked about that. Is it the financial budget? I don't think when you present and you really want to affect type of change that you have to necessarily have an emotional argument. You need a broader argument to deliver. Could you talk to that? In terms of, you know, is it the numbers that resonates with them? Is it the data? Really, what are they looking for to be persuaded?
I think it's a little bit of all, and that's why you need to do the homework. For example, counting. One of the things that we do with Gale Architects around the world is do a lot of counting, because in many cities we end up seeing that there is more pedestrians on a street than people moving in their cars. So all of the same, when we bring this data to the people, for example, on Broadway Avenue in New York, when we showed the city government that there were many more pedestrians along Broadway than people on the cars, they were amazed. They couldn't believe it. So then all of a sudden this became the pedestrians that seemed invisible, all of a sudden they became visible. And that's one of the things. But also, so you need data, you need information, because some of people are going to be convinced in an emotional way, but others are going to be more rational. So I think that you have to do a little bit of both. And show, for example, that street that I showed in Copenhagen, how come it was so good for economic development, but other people might want to see it more from the point of view of having cities that are more human and more enjoyable.
Okay, this side, we only have time for a couple more questions, I think. We can move quickly.
Hi there. My question is about American car culture, because here in San Francisco, when you raised the question about the bikeway on the bridge, it made me think about the fact that this is a city where the car issues that come up, removing parking spaces, adding, making pedestrian streets, etc., a lot of times it's residents of the city are fine with that. They get around by bike, they get around by public transportation, but we have this huge influx of cars that come in from the whole region to work here. It's the economic center of the region. And so what we run into, like the simple answer is, oh, well, we need better connections to public transit, like the regional rail, et cetera. But as soon as you start talking about expanding rail, regional rail, and building big facilities, stations, trains, and all that, the expense gets so big that I feel like the political will is lost. It's sort of like we're fine on the local level, but this is a city that's greatly affected by its region. And then when we talk on the regional level, I feel like things sort of fall apart. Have you had experience helping a region sort of come to the same conclusion?
Well, I know that you don't like Los Angeles very much. But last week, there was a proposition in a very difficult economic crisis. But there was a proposition to increase 1% the sales tax, to put that money into mass transit and into a regional train. And nevertheless, it was approved. So, and under a very difficult economic crisis, because if things were going well, you know, maybe people say, oh, you know, it's easy to approve it. But when people were losing jobs and whatever, and, you know, in Los Angeles, the highways were 6 lanes and they were full. They made it 8 lanes, they got full. They went at 10 lanes, they got full. So finally, the people realized that they are going to have to invest in public transit. And part of investing in public transit is that they have to pay.
I think maybe one more real quick.
Perhaps you should have him after me. I grew up in Calgary, and I remember it as a lovely city, view of mountains, hills. You could ride your bike, which I did, everywhere, and I've gone back recently. They've developed the island downtown. There's parks everywhere. And I didn't hear everything you said, but I was wondering how much time you spent in Calgary.
No, you know, I just did a study with Project for Public Spaces on how to improve the parks and public places in the city center, mm-hmm. because one of the things that is happening is that through the oil and all of this, they are attracting people through good salaries, but they are not retaining them. And
it's very, very cold in the winter.
No, but they are moving to other cities just as cold as Calgary. But that's not the issue. But the main roads where you got all of the plus 15s, it's pretty lifeless on the street level. So I think also, for example, those beautiful trails that are along the river,
yes.
they have to be connected with the city center. There is no connection between those trails to the city center. And things like the Olympic Plaza. When I was saying about not management of the public places, that's a typical place. They invested millions in building the Olympic Plaza, but nothing happens. So they're starting to invest a little bit more on it.
Okay.
So I think that they're becoming aware that public places need to be managed. And it's not totally good or totally bad. They are doing some good things. For example, public transit in Calgary in the downtown is free, which is really good incentive for people, like you were saying, on the cars, so they can drive, leave their cars outside, and take public transit, because once you are in the city center, it's free, and things like that.
Thank you.
Maybe one more, if you move real quick. We've got 1 minute. Remember, this is on the radio,
question.
So we have to keep it precise.
I'll try to keep it really brief. I'm an urban designer, and one of the things I love about engineers, actually, is that they solve problems. They just solve the problems that they're asked to solve. They're also looked to as the experts sometimes, and often, you know, to solve, they sometimes recommend solving the same problems they've always been solving. How do you inspire engineers to want to work with you to solve different problems?
Well, I think that one of the things is not blaming them for everything, because the poor engineers, they can say, some people say, if the transportation engineer says something, do the opposite and you'll be right. No. They are fantastic transportation engineers. They're fantastic people. But also they have to realize, you know, the DOT, for example, some of the things that the DOT is doing in New York is transforming, that is becoming the most likable department in the city. You know, for example, transportation has the biggest budget in public works in almost any city. So all of a sudden, if they realize that their job is not how to move cars, but how to move people, and they start thinking about pedestrians and cyclists and before cars, then all of a sudden they might become very likable, and they might play a fantastic role, because they can transform the way cities are created and the way cities function and the way people, all of this mobility. What's really, really interesting is that all of this is doable. We're not talking about rocket science, but it might seem like rocket science is to get things done. So there are plenty of examples and plenty of ways, and I think that and a great city like San Francisco can be even greater. So the important thing is never to give up and never to be complacent, and always to realize that you are never finished.
Thank you so much. Let's give a big, big hand to Gil Peñalosa for sharing his thoughts with us tonight. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.